story would be in the morning print edition of the Times, but it wasn't Chu.
Hannah, I'm working.
Oh, I thought maybe we could talk.
Well, I'm alone now and have a few minutes, but like I said, I'm working.
Is it a crime scene?
No, an interview you could call it. What's up, Hannah?
Well, two things. Is there any update on the case involving Clayton Pell? Clayton asks me about it every time I see him. I wish there was something to tell him.
Well, there really isn't. It kind of got backburnered while I work on this other thing. But that is ending now, and I'll be back on the Pell case pretty quick. You can tell Clayton that. We'll find Chilton Hardy. I guarantee it.
Okay, that's good, Harry.
What's the other thing you wanted to talk about?
He knew what it was, but it was her call. She had to ask it. Us, Harry. I know I messed things up with my issues about my son. I am sorry about that, and I hope it didn't completely spoil things. I like you a lot, and I hope we can see each other again. Bosch pulled to a stop in front of his house. His daughter had left the porch light on. He stayed in the car.
Hannah, the truth is all I've been doing is working. I've got two cases here, and I'm trying to work them both.
Why don't we see how we feel over the weekend? Or early next week. I'll call you then. Or you can call me if you want. Okay, Harry. We'll talk next week.
Yes, Hannah. Good night, and have a good weekend.
Bosch opened the car door and practically had to roll out of the car. He was tired. The burden of knowledge was heavy, and all he wanted was to crash into a black dream where nothing could find him.
Chapter 31
Bosch got into the squad room late Friday morning because his daughter had been late in getting ready for school. By the time he entered and headed toward his cubicle, the rest of the open unsolved unit was in place. He could tell they were watching him without watching him, and this told him that the story he had told David Chu to feed to Emily Gomez-Gonsmart had been published that morning in the Times. As he entered his cubicle, Harry threw a casual glance toward the lieutenant's office and noted that the door was closed and the blinds were down. She was either late herself or hiding. A copy of the Times was waiting for Bosch on his desk, courtesy of his partner. "You see it yet?" Chu asked from his seat.
"No, I don't get the Times."
Bosch sat down, putting his briefcase on the floor next to his chair. He didn't have to hunt through the newspaper for the story. It was on the bottom left corner of the front page. The headline was all he needed to read. LAPD. Councilman's son's death ruled suicide. He noted that the byline was shared by Emily Gomez-Gonsmart and another reporter named Tad Hemmings, whom Bosch had never heard of. He was about to read it anyway when his desk phone buzzed. It was Tim Marcia, the squad whip.
"Harry, you and Chu have a forthwith from the chief's office. The lieutenant's already up there and they're waiting for you."
"I was hoping to get a cup of coffee. But I guess we'd better go up."
"Yeah, I would. Good luck up there. I heard the councilman was in the building."
"Thanks for the heads up."
Bosch stood and turned to Chu, who was on the phone. Bosch pointed toward the ceiling, meaning they were going upstairs. Chu got off his call and got up, grabbing his sport coat off the back of his chair. "The chief's office?" he asked.
"Yeah, they're waiting for us."
"How do we play this?"
"You talk as little as possible. Let me answer the questions. If you don't agree with something I say, don't show it or say it. Just agree with it."
"Whatever you say, Harry."
"Yeah, whatever I say."
There was no need for further discussion. They took the elevator up in silence, and when they entered the OCP, they were immediately whisked into a meeting room where the chief of police waited. It was the fastest Bosch had ever been able to gain an audience with a member of the department's command staff, let alone the chief himself. The boardroom looked like it belonged in a downtown law firm. Long, polished table, glass wall of views across the civic center. Seated at the head of the table was the chief of police, and to his right was Kiz Ryder.
The three seats going down one side of the table were taken by Councilman Irvin Irving and two members of his staff whom Bosch didn't know, but recognized from the city car that waited for the councilman outside of the chateau on Monday morning. Across from them sat Lieutenant Duval, with her back to the city view, and she signaled Bosch and Chu to the seats next to her. Eight people in a meeting about one suicide, Bosch noted, and nobody in the entire building who gave a shit about Lily Price being dead for 20 years or Chilton Hardy being free for just as long. The chief did the talking first. All right, everybody's here. I'm sure everybody's seen the Times today or read it online. I think everybody is a bit surprised by the public turn this case has taken, and
more than surprised, Irving cut in. I want to know why the L.A. goddamn Times had this information before I did, before my son's family did. He stabbed a finger down on the table to hammer home his outrage. Luckily, Bosch was seated on a swivel chair. This allowed him to calmly pivot and look at the faces across from him and at the head of the table. He said nothing in response, waiting for the power in the room to tell him to speak. That power was not Irvin Irving, no matter how hard he hit the table with his stubby finger.
Detective Bosch, the chief finally said, tell us what you know about this.
Bosch nodded and swiveled back so that he was directly facing Irving. First of all, I don't know anything about the story in the paper. It didn't come from me, but it doesn't surprise me. This investigation has been leaking like a sieve since day one, whether it was coming out of the OCP or the city council staff or RHD doesn't matter. The story is out there and it's accurate. And I want to correct one thing the city councilman said. The victim's immediate family was informed of our conclusions. The victim's wife, in fact, provided the information that was most important to my partner and me in calling the death a suicide.
Deborah, Irving said, she told you nothing.
In your presence, she told us nothing. That is correct. It was during a subsequent interview that she was more forthcoming about the details of her marriage and her husband's life and work. Irving leaned back, dragging a bald fist on the table.
I was informed by this office just yesterday that this was a homicide investigation, that there was evidence of assault on my son's body prior to the fatal impact, and that it was likely that there was a former or current police officer involved. Now today I pick up the paper and read something completely different. I read that it's a suicide. You know what this is? This is a payback, and it's a cover-up, and I will formally petition the council for an independent review of your so-called investigation, and I will ask the district attorney, whoever that may be after next month's election, to also review the case and its handling.
Irv, the chief said, you asked for Detective Bosch to be put on the case. You said let the chips fall. And now you don't like how they have fallen? So you want to investigate how it was investigated?
The chief went back long enough in the department to call the councilman by his first name. No one else in the room would even dare.
I chose him because I thought he had the integrity not to be swayed from the truth. But what obviously has...
Harry Bosch has more integrity than anybody I've ever met.
Anybody in this room.
It was Chu, and the whole room looked at him, shocked by his outburst. Even Bosch was taken aback.
We're not going to get into personal attacks here, the chief said. We first want to...
If there is an investigation of the investigation, Bosch said, daring to cut the chief off, it will most likely lead to your indictment, councilman. That stunned the group, but Irving recovered quickly.
How dare you?
Irving said, his eyes full of growing rage.
How dare you say such a thing about me in front of other people? I will have your badge for this. I have served this city for nearly 50 years, and not once has anyone accused me of any impropriety. I am less than a month from being re-elected to my seat for the fourth time, and you won't stop me or the will of the people who want me to represent them.
A silence followed. during which one of Irving's aides opened a leather folder with a legal pad inside. He wrote something down on the pad, and Bosch half imagined it was "Take Bosch's badge."
"Detective Bosch," Ryder said, "why don't you explain your statement?"
It was said with a tone of shock and maybe even outrage, as if she was joining the defense of Irving's reputation. But Bosch knew that she was giving him the entree he needed to say what he wanted. George Irving billed himself as a lobbyist, but he wasn't really much more than a fixer and a bagman. He sold influence. He used his own connections as a former cop and assistant city attorney, but his most notable connection was to his father, the city councilman. You wanted something? He could get it to his father. You wanted a concrete supply contract or a taxi franchise? George was the man to see because he could get it done. Bosch looked directly at Irving when he mentioned the taxi franchise. He saw a slight tremor in one eyelid and took it as a tell. He wasn't saying anything the old man didn't already know.
"This is outrageous," Irving bellowed. "I want this stopped. This man is using a long-held grudge to tarnish what I have worked for all my life."
Bosch stopped and waited. He knew this was the moment when the police chief would choose sides. It was going to be him or Irving.
"I think we need to hear what Detective Bosch has to say," the chief said.
He shared his own hard stare with Irving, and Bosch knew that the chief was taking a major gamble. He was positioning himself against a powerful force in city government. He was banking on Bosch, and Harry knew he had Kiz Ryder to thank for that.
"Go ahead, Detective," the chief said.
Bosch leaned forward so he could look directly down the table at the chief. A couple months ago, George Irving parted ways with his closest friend, a cop he had known since the police academy. The friendship ended when the cop realized George and his father had been using him without his knowledge to help swing a lucrative taxi franchise toward one of George's clients. The cop was asked directly by the councilman to start hitting the existing franchise holder with DUI spot checks, knowing that a file full of such stops or arrests would damage their efforts to retain the franchise. Irving leaned across the table and pointed a finger at Bosch.
"This is where you are way off base," he said. "I know who you are talking about, and that was a request made in response to a complaint to my office. It was a request passed on in a social setting, nothing more. In fact, it was my grandson's graduation party."
Bosch nodded. "Yes, a party that occurred 2 weeks after your son signed a $100,000 service contract with Regent Taxi, which would later announce plans to seek the city franchise currently being held by the company you complained about. I'm just guessing, but I think a grand jury would find the coincidence of that hard to believe. I am sure your office would be able to provide the name of the citizen who made the complaint, and she and her story would be vetted." Bosch pointedly looked at the aide with the legal pad. "You might want to write that down." He turned his attention back to the head of the table. The officer in question learned that he was being used by the Irvings and confronted George Irving. Their friendship ended there. In the course of 4 weeks, George lost three of the most important people in his life. His friend exposed him as a user, if not a criminal. His only child left his home for college and life after. And last week, his wife of 20 years told him she was leaving. She had stayed in the marriage until their son was gone, and now she, too, was finished. Irving reacted as if slapped in the face. He clearly knew nothing about the implosion of the marriage. "George tried for a week to talk Deborah out of her decision," Bosch continued, "to no avail. On Sunday, 12 hours before his death, he bought his son an airplane ticket to come home the next day. The plan was to tell the boy of the split. But instead, that night, George checked into the Chateau Marmont with no luggage. He specifically asked for Suite 79 because that was the suite he and Deborah shared on their honeymoon. He spent about 5 hours in that room, probably considering his life and where it had led him. He was visited by a former cop named Mark McQuillan, who knew by happenstance that he was in the hotel. McQuillan had been run out of the police department in a political witch hunt headed by Deputy Chief Irving 25 years ago. Now he was part owner of the taxi franchise George Irving was trying to destroy. He confronted George in the room and, yes, assaulted him, but he didn't throw him from that balcony. After McQuillan was gone, George did that himself. I have come to no other conclusion. He jumped. Bosch leaned back in his chair, finished with his report. There was no immediate response from anyone at the table. It took Irving a few moments to look at all the angles in the story and come up with something. McQuillan should be placed under arrest. This was obviously a carefully planned crime. I was correct when I said it was a payback. McQuillan perceived that I took his career. He took my son's life. McQuillan has an alibi for the time of death, and it holds up, Bosch said. He was with your son more than 2 hours before his death. We have a witness, and we have video. He was not in the hotel when your son jumped. And there's the airline ticket, Chu added. Chad Irving was already flying down Monday. It wasn't because his father had died, as the family suggested to us Monday. He had the ticket before, and there is no way McQuillan could have made that play. Bosch glanced at his partner. Chu had disobeyed Bosch's order to maintain silence twice now, but both times it had been to great effect. Councilman Irving, I think we've heard enough for now, the chief said. Detectives Bosch and Chu, I want the full summary of the investigation on my desk before 2 o'clock today. I'll review it and then I'll hold a press conference. I plan to keep it brief and keep the details of the investigation brief. Councilman, you are invited to join me if you like, but I know that this is a very personal matter and you may want it to close up and simply go away. I'll expect to hear from your office if you are coming. The chief nodded once and waited a split second for any reply. There was none, and so he stood up. The meeting was over, and so was the case. Irving knew he could press it and call for reviews and reinvestigations, but that path would be fraught with political peril. Bosch had him pegged as a pragmatist who would let this one go. The question was, would the police chief? Bosch had delivered the elements of a crime of political corruption. It would be difficult to pursue, particularly with a key player dead, and it was unknown what they could get by leaning on the people at Regent Taxi. Would the chief follow up, or would he hold it as an ace in a card game played on a level Bosch knew nothing about? Either way, Bosch was pretty sure he had just delivered to the chief the means of turning a powerful anti-police voice in city government toward the positive. If he worked it right, he might even be able to get the overtime budget funded again. Meantime, Bosch was satisfied that he had completed his job. An old nemesis now had renewed enmity toward him, but that was of no consequence. Bosch would never be able to live in a world without enemies. It came with the turf. Everyone stood to leave the meeting, which was going to present an awkward situation when Irving and Bosch went out and waited for the elevator together. Ryder saved Harry from it by inviting him into her office, along with Chu. As the Irving entourage left the suite of offices, Bosch and Chu followed Ryder into her space. "Can I get you men something?" she asked. I guess the time to have asked was at the start of the meeting. I'm good, Bosch said. Same here, Chu said. Ryder appraised Chu. She had no idea about Chu's traitorous activities. "That was good work, gentlemen," she said. "And Detective Chu, I admire your willingness to stand up in there for your partner and your case. Well done." "Thank you, Lieutenant. Now, do you mind stepping out into the waiting area? I have some things to discuss with Detective Bosch relating to his drop date." "No problem. Harry, I'll be out here." Chu left, and Ryder closed the door. She and Bosch were left looking at each other for a long moment. She then slowly broke into a smile and shook her head.
"You must have been loving that in there," she said. "Seeing Irving have to shut down or be put down like the dog he is."
Bosch shook his head.
"Not really. I don't care about him anymore."
"I still don't get it, though.
Why did he really want me on the case?"
"I think it was exactly what he said. He knew you would be relentless, and he needed to know if somebody went through his son to get to him. The only thing is, he didn't think you'd get to the place you got to."
Bosch nodded. "Maybe."
"Now, the chief didn't show it in front of Irving, but you just gave him the golden ticket. And the good news is, he's going to be happy to reward you. I was thinking I'd start by getting your drop moved up to the whole 5 years. How would that be, Harry?" She smiled, anticipating that Bosch would be delighted by the additional 21 months on the job.
"Let me think about that," he said.
"You sure? You might want to strike while the iron's hot."
"Tell you what. See if you can get Chu moved out of OU, but keep him in RHD. Get him a good gig over there."
She narrowed her eyes, and he continued before she could speak.
"And do it, no questions asked."
"You sure you don't want to talk to me about this?"
"No, Kiz, I don't."
"Okay, I'll see what I can do. Irving's probably down the elevator by now. You should get back down to OU to work on your report. By 2 o'clock, remember?"
"See you at 2.
Bosch stepped out of the office and closed the door behind him. Chu was waiting there, smiling with pride over the stand he had made and completely unknowing that his career path had just been set without a word of input or preference from him.
Chapter 32. Saturday started early for Bosch and his daughter. While still in darkness, they drove down out of the hills, took the 101 freeway into downtown, and then pivoted south on the 110 toward Long Beach. They caught the first ferry over to Catalina, Bosch never letting go of the locked gun case, as they rode into a cold gray dawn. Once on the island, they ate breakfast at the Pancake Cottage in Avalon, the only place Harry had ever thought compared favorably to DuPar's back in L.A. Bosch wanted his daughter to eat a full breakfast, because the plan was to eat lunch late in the day, after the pistol competition. He knew that the little tickle of hunger she'd get in the early afternoon would help her stay focused and keep her aim tight. A year earlier, when she had announced to him that her plan was to become a police officer, she had begun learning about guns and their safe use and storage. There was no philosophical debate about it. Bosch was a cop, and there were guns in the house. It was simply a given, and he considered it good parenting to teach his daughter how to use and safeguard the weapons. He supplemented his mentoring by enrolling her in courses at a firing range up in Newhall. But Maddie had taken it far past a rudimentary knowledge of practice and safety. She took to shooting at paper targets with a passion and developed a steady hand and cold eye. Within 6 months, her marksmanship put her father's to shame. They ended each training lesson with a one-on-one match, and she soon became unbeatable. She owned the 10 ring at 10 yards and could keep her aim steady through a 16-round clip. Soon, beating her old man with his own guns was not enough, and that brought them to Catalina. Maddie's first competition was a junior match at the gun club on the backside of the island. It was a single-elimination pistol match that would pit her against all teenage entrants. each face-off involved shooting 6 rounds at paper targets from 10, 15, and 25 yards. They had chosen Catalina for her first foray into competitive shooting because it was a small tournament and they knew they could make a fun day of it, no matter how she performed. Maddie had never been to Catalina, and Harry had not been out to the barrier island in years. As it turned out, she was the only girl in the competition. It was Maddie and 7 boys, randomly bracketed into one-on-one matches. She won her first match going away, overcoming a weak grouping on the 10-yard target to hit 7 of 8 rings in the 15 and 25-yard distances. Bosch was so proud and happy for her that he wanted to rush to the line and hug her, but he held back, knowing it would only underline that she was the only girl. Instead, he was the lone spectator applauding from the picnic tables behind the shooting line. He then put on his sunglasses, so no stranger would see the look in his eyes. His daughter was eliminated in the next round by a single ring shot, but took the disappointment well. The fact that she had competed and won her first match had made the journey worth it. She and Bosch stuck around to watch the final round, and then the start of the adult competition. Maddie tried to goad Harry into entering the adult round, but he demurred. His eyes were not what they once were, and he knew he didn't stand a chance. They ate a late lunch at the Busy Bee, and window-shopped along Crescent before catching the 4 o'clock ferry back to the mainland. They sat inside because the sea air was cold, and along the way Bosch put his arm around his daughter's shoulders. He knew that other girls her age weren't learning about guns and shooting. They weren't watching their fathers at night, poring over murder books and autopsies and crime scene photos. They weren't left alone in the house while their fathers went out with their guns to chase bad guys. Most parents were raising citizens of the future. Doctors, teachers, mothers, keepers of family businesses. Bosch was raising a warrior. A momentary thought of Hannah Stone and her son shot through him, and he squeezed his daughter's shoulder again. He had been thinking about something, and it was now time to discuss it. "You know," he said, "you don't have to do any of this if you don't want to. Don't do it for me, Mads. The gun stuff, the being a cop thing, too. You do what you want to do. You make your own choices." "I know, Dad. I do make my own choices. And it's what I want. We talked about this a long time ago." It was Bosch's hope that she would be able to leave her past behind and forge something new. He had been unable to do it himself, and it haunted him that she might be the same way. "Okay, baby. There's a lot of time between now and then, anyway." A few minutes went by while he thought of things. He could see the disguised oil derricks in the harbor just coming into view. A call came in on a cell, and he saw it was from David Chu. He let it go to message. He wasn't going to spoil this moment with work, or more likely Chu groveling for a second chance. He put the phone away and kissed the top of his daughter's head. "I guess I'll always have to worry about you," he said. "It's not like you could want to be a teacher or something safe like that."
"I hate school, Dad. Why would I want to be a teacher?"
"I don't know. To change the system, make it better so the next kids don't hate it."
"One teacher? Forget it. It just takes one.
It always starts with one. Anyway, like I said, you do what you want. You've got time. I guess I'll worry about you no matter what you do."
"Not if you teach me all you know. Then you won't have to worry, because I'll be like you out there."
Bosch laughed. "If you're like me out there, then I'll have to walk around all day with rosary beads in one hand, a rabbit's foot in the other, and maybe a 4-leaf clover tattooed on my arm." She drove an elbow into his side. Bosch let another few minutes go by. He pulled his phone and checked to see if Chu had left a message. There was nothing, and Bosch figured his partner had been calling to once again plead his case. It was not the kind of thing you would put into a voicemail. He put the phone away and turned the father-daughter conversation more serious.
Look, Mads, I've been wanting to tell you something else, too.
I know. You're marrying the lady with the lipstick?
No. Serious now. And there was no lipstick.
I know. What is it?
Well, I'm thinking about turning in my badge. Retiring. It might be time. She didn't respond for a long time. He had expected an immediate and urgent demand that he trash such thoughts, but to her credit, she seemed to be running it through her processes and not kicking out a first and possibly wrong response.
But why? She finally asked.
Well, I am thinking that I'm tailing off, you know? Like anything, athletics, shooting, playing music, even creative thinking, there's a drop-off of skills at a certain point. And I don't know, but maybe I'm getting there, and I should get out. I've seen people lose their edge, and it increases the danger. I don't want to miss the chance to see you grow up and shine at whatever you decide you want to do. She nodded as if in agreement, but then the keen perception and disagreement came out.
You're thinking all of this because of one case?
Not just the one case. But that's a good example. I totally went the wrong way with it. I have to think that wouldn't have happened 5 years ago, even 2 years ago. I might be losing the edge you need to do this.
But sometimes you have to go the wrong way to find the right way.
She turned in her seat to look directly at him.
Like you told me, you make your own choices. But if I were you, I wouldn't do anything real quick.
I'm not. There's a guy out there that I have to find first. I was thinking that would be a good one to go out on.
But what would you do if you quit?
I'm not sure, but I know one thing. I think I would be able to be a better father. You know, be around more.
That doesn't necessarily make you a better father. Remember that.
Bosch nodded. He sometimes had a hard time believing he was talking to a 15-year-old. This was one of those times. Chapter 33. On Sunday morning, Bosch dropped his daughter off at the mall in Century City. The day had been reserved a week earlier for her and her friends Ashlyn and Connor to meet at the mall at 11 and then spend the day shopping, eating, and gossiping. The girls scheduled mall days once a month and targeted a different shopping center each time. This time, Bosch felt the most comfortable leaving them on their own. No mall was safe from predators, but he knew that security would be at its maximum on a Sunday, and the Century City Mall had a good record of vigilance. They had undercover officers posing as shoppers all through the place, and much of the weekend security force was comprised of moonlighting cops. On most mall Sundays, Bosch would head downtown after the daughter drop and work in the deserted OU squad room. He liked the stillness of the place on the weekends, and it usually brought a strong focus to his casework. But this time, he wanted to stay away from the PAB. He had picked up the Times early that morning when he went down the hill to buy milk and coffee at the convenience store. Standing in line, he had noticed that there was another front-page story related to George Irving's death. He bought the paper and read the story in the car. Reported by Emily Gomez Gonsmart, it focused on George Irving's work for Regent Taxi and raised questions about the seeming coincidence of his representation of the company and the rise of legal issues that befell Black and White, its competitor for the Hollywood area franchise. The story made the leap to Irvin Irving. Arrest records led them to Officer Robert Mason, who told the same tale of being directly asked by the councilman to crack down on B&W. Bosch guessed that the story was going to cause a stir at the PAB as well as City Hall. He would steer clear of the place until he had to go into work the next morning. As he drove away from the mall, Bosch pulled his phone to make sure it was on. He was surprised he had not heard from Chu, if only to deny that he was the source who had steered Gogo toward the story. He was also surprised not to have received a call from Kiz Ryder. The fact that it was closing in on noon and she had not called him about the story told him one thing.
that she was the story's source and was laying low herself. Either on her own, or more likely in concert with the chief's tacit direction, the play had been to out Irvin Irving rather than coerce his cooperation through silence. It was hard not to agree with the choice. Dangling him out there in the media, tainting him with the brush of corruption, could serve to eliminate him as a threat to the department. A lot could happen in the final month of an election campaign. Maybe the chief had decided to take his best shot now and see if the story might gather steam and affect the outcome of the election. Maybe he wanted to take the chance that Irving's opponent would be a friend to the department rather than a compromised and coerced enemy. It didn't really matter to Bosch either way. It was all high jingo. But what did matter to him was that Kiz Ryder, his friend and former partner, was now fully ensconced on the 10th floor as a political operative. He knew he had to keep that in mind as he had further dealings with her, and that conclusion hit him like a deep loss. He knew his best move at this point was to keep his own head down. He was sure now that he was marking his last days in the department. The 39 months he had been so happy to receive a week ago now seemed almost like a sentence to be served. He'd take the afternoon off and steer clear of the PAB and everything else about the job. While he had the phone out, he took a flyer and called Hannah Stone's cell. She answered right away.
"Hannah, are you at home or work?"
"Home. No therapy on Sundays. What's up?"
"Did you find Chilton Hardy?"
There was an excited tone of anticipation in her voice.
No, not yet. But he'll be the priority starting tomorrow. Actually, I was calling because I sort of have the afternoon free, until I pick my daughter up around 5 at the mall. I thought if you were off and had the day free, we could have lunch or something. I want to talk about things. You know, see if we can't find a way to try this.
The truth was, Bosch couldn't quite dismiss her. He had always been drawn to women hiding tragedy behind their eyes. He had been thinking about Hannah and believed that if they just set certain boundaries in regard to her son, then they might be able to carve out a chance for themselves.
"That would be great, Harry. I want to talk, too. Do you want to come here?"
Bosch checked the dash clock. "I'm in Century City. I think I can be there by about 12 to pick you up. Maybe you can think of a place to go on Ventura Boulevard. Hell, I'm even willing to try sushi."
She laughed, and Bosch liked the sound of it.
"No, I meant come here," she said, "for lunch and to talk. We can just stay here and be private, and I can just make something. Nothing fancy. And then we'll just see what happens."
"You sure?"
"Of course."
Bosch nodded to himself.
"Okay, then I'm on my way."
Chapter 34. David Chu was already in the cubicle when Bosch arrived for work Monday morning. When he saw Harry, he swiveled in his chair and raised his hands in a hands-off manner as Bosch entered.
"Harry, all I can say is that it wasn't me."
Bosch put his briefcase down and checked his desk for messages and delivered reports. There was nothing.
"What are you talking about?"
"The Times story. Did you see it?"
"Don't worry, I know it wasn't you."
"Then who was it?"
Bosch pointed toward the ceiling as he sat down, meaning the story had come from the 10th floor.
"Hi, Jingo," he said. "Somebody up there decided this is the play."
"To control Irving?"
"To move him out. Change the election. Anyway, it's not our business anymore. We turned in the report, and that one's done. Today, it's Chilton Hardy. I want to find him. He's been running free for 22 years. I want him in a cell by the end of the day."
"Yeah, you know, I called you Saturday. I came in to do some stuff, and I was wondering if you wanted to take a ride down to see the father. But I guess you had daughter stuff. You didn't answer."
Yeah, I had daughter stuff, and you didn't leave a message. What did you come in to do?
Chu turned back to his desk and pointed to his computer screen. Just backgrounding Hardy as much as I can, he said. Not a lot there on him. More on his father buying and selling properties. Chilton Aaron Hardy Sr. He's lived down there in Los Alamitos for 15 years. It's a condo, and he owns it outright.
Bosch nodded. It was good intel.
I also tried to find a Mrs. Hardy. You know, in case there was a divorce and she's living somewhere and could be a lead to Junior?
And?
And no go. Came up with an obituary from 97 for Hilda Ames Hardy, wife of Chilton Sr. and mother of Chilton Jr. Breast cancer. It listed no other children.
So it looks like we go down to Los Alamitos.
Yeah.
Then let's get out of here before the shit hits the fan on that story. Bring the file with the DMV photo of Pell.
Why Pell?
Because Senior may be predisposed not to give up Junior. I think we run a play on him, and that's where Pell comes in. Bosch stood up. I'll go move the magnets.
It was a 40-minute drive south. Los Alamitos was at the northern tip of Orange County and one of a dozen or so small contiguous bedroom communities between Anaheim on the east and Seal Beach to the west. On the way down, Bosch and Chu worked out how they would handle the interview with Chilton Hardy Sr. They then cruised through his neighborhood off of Catella Avenue and near the Los Alamitos Medical Center before stopping at the curb in front of a complex of townhouses. They were built in sets of six, with long-running front lawns and double garages off rear alleys.
Bring the file, Bosch said. Let's go.
There was a main sidewalk that led past a bank of mailboxes to a network of individual walkways leading to the front doors of the residences. Hardy Sr.'s home was the second one in. There was a screen door in front of a closed front door. Without hesitation, Bosch pushed a doorbell button and then rapped his knuckles on the aluminum frame of the screen. They waited 15 seconds, and there was no response. Bosch hit the button again and raised his fist to hit the frame when he heard a muffled voice call out from inside.
"Someone's in there," he said.
Another 15 seconds went by, and then the voice came again, this time clearly from right on the other side of the door.
Yeah?
Mr. Hardy?
Yeah, what?
It's the police. Open your door.
What happened?
We need to ask you some questions. Open the door, please. There was no reply. Mr. Hardy?
They heard the sound of the deadbolt lock turning. Slowly, the door opened, and a man with Coke bottle-thick glasses peered out at them through a 6-inch opening. He was disheveled, his gray hair unkempt and matted, 2 weeks of white whiskers sprouted on his face. A clear plastic tube was looped over both ears and then under his nose, delivering oxygen to his nostrils. He wore what looked like a pale blue hospital smock over striped pajama pants and black plastic sandals. Bosch tried to open the screen door, but it was locked.
Mr. Hardy, we need to talk with you, sir. Can we come in?
What is it?
We're down from the LAPD, and we are looking for someone. We think you might be able to help us. Can we come in, sir?
Who?
Sir, we can't do this out on the street. Can we come in to discuss this? The man's eyes lowered a moment as he considered things. They were cold and distant. Bosch saw where his son's eyes had come from. Slowly, the old man reached through the opening and unlocked the screen door. Bosch opened it and then waited for Hardy to back away from the front door before pushing through. Hardy moved slowly, leaning on a cane as he walked into the living room. Over one bony shoulder, he had a strap which supported a small oxygen canister attached to the network of tubes that led to his nose.
"The place isn't clean,"
he said as he moved toward a chair.
"I don't have visitors."
"That's all right, Mr. Hardy," Bosch said.
Hardy slowly lowered himself into a well-used cushioned chair. On the table next to it was an overloaded ashtray. The house smelled of cigarettes and old age, and was as unkempt as Hardy's person. Bosch started to breathe through his mouth. Hardy saw him looking at the ashtray.
"You're not going to tell the hospital on me, are you?"
"No, Mr. Hardy, that's not why we're here. My name is Bosch, and this is Detective Chu. We are trying to locate your son, Chilton Hardy Jr." Hardy nodded as if expecting this.
"I don't know where he's at these days. What do you want with him?"
Bosch sat down on a couch with frayed cushion covers so he would be on Hardy's eye level. "All right if I sit here, Mr. Hardy?"
"Suit yourself. What's my boy gone and done that brings you here?"
Bosch shook his head. "As far as we know, nothing. We want to talk to him about somebody else. We are doing a background investigation on a man we believe lived with your son a number of years ago."
"Who?"
"His name is Clayton Pell. Did you ever meet him?"
"Clayton Powell?"
"No, sir. Pell. Clayton Pell. Do you know that name?"
"I don't think so."
Hardy leaned forward and started coughing into his hand. His body jerked with spasms.
"Goddamn cigarettes. What's this Pell character done, then?"
"We can't really reveal the details of our investigation. Suffice it to say, we think he's done some bad things, and it would help us in dealing with him if we knew his background. We have a photo we'd like to show you." Chu produced the mugshot of Pell. Hardy studied it for a long time before shaking his head.
"Don't recognize him."
"Well, that's him now. He lived with your son about 20 years ago." Hardy now seemed surprised.
20 years ago? He'd be just a... Oh, I know. You're talking about that boy who lived with Chilton, with his mother up there in Hollywood."
"Close to Hollywood, yes. He would have been about 8 years old back then. You remember him now?" Hardy nodded, and that made him start to cough again. "Do you need some water, Mr. Hardy?" Hardy waved off the offer, but continued a wheezing cough that left spittle on his lips.
"Chilton came around here with him a couple times. That's all."
"Did he ever talk to you about the boy?"
"He just said he was a handful. His mother would go off and leave him with Chilton. Chilton wasn't the father type."
Bosch nodded as though it was important information. "Where's Chilton now?"
"I told you I don't know. He doesn't visit me anymore."
"When was the last time you saw him?" Hardy scratched the stubble on his chin and then coughed into his hand once more. Bosch looked up at Chu, who was still standing. "Partner, can you go get him some water?"
"No, I'm fine,"
Hardy protested. But Chu had gotten the partner message and went down the hallway next to the staircase to a kitchen or bathroom. Bosch knew it would give him the chance to take a quick look around the first floor of the townhouse. "Do you remember when you last saw your son?" Bosch asked again.
No, actually. The years... I don't know."
Bosch nodded as though he knew how families and parents and children could drift apart over time. Chu came back with a glass of water from a sink. The glass didn't look very clean. There were smears of handprints on it. As he handed it to Hardy, he gave Bosch a furtive shake of his head. He had not seen anything useful in his quick foray into the house. Hardy drank from the glass, and Bosch tried once again to get a line on his son. "Do you have a phone number or an address for your son, Mr. Hardy? We would really like to talk to him." Hardy put the glass down next to the ashtray. He reached a hand up to where the breast pocket of his shirt would be, but he had no pocket on the smock he was wearing. It was a subconscious move to a pack of cigarettes that weren't there. Bosch remembered doing that himself, back when he was addicted.
I don't have a phone number,
he said. What about an address? Bosch asked.
Nope.
Hardy cast his eyes down as he seemed to register that his answers were a testament to his failings as a father, or his namesake's failings as a son. As Bosch often did in interviews, he jumped non-sequentially in his questions. He also dropped the ruse of the visit. He no longer cared whether the old man thought they were investigating Clayton Pell or his son. Did your son live with you while he was growing up? Hardy's thick glasses magnified his eye movements. The question got a reaction. Rapid eye movement as an answer was formulated as a tell.
His mother and I got divorced. That was early on. I didn't see much of Chilton. We lived far apart. His mother, she's dead now. She raised him. I sent her money.
Said as if the money was his only duty. Bosch nodded, continuing the pose of understanding and sympathy. Did she ever tell you about him being in trouble or anything like that?
I thought you told me you were looking for that boy, Powell. Why are you asking about my son growing up?
Pell, Mr. Hardy, Clayton Pell.
You're not here about him, are you?
That was it. The play was over. Bosch started to stand. Your son isn't here, is he?
I told you I don't know where he is.
Then you wouldn't mind if we took a look around for him, right? Hardy wiped his mouth and shook his head.
You need a warrant for that, he said.
Not if there is a safety issue involved, Bosch said. Why don't you just sit right there, Mr. Hardy, and I'll take a quick look around. Detective Chu will stay with you.
No, I don't need...
I'm just going to make sure you're safe here, that's all. Bosch left them there with Chu attempting to calm Hardy's agitation. He moved down the hallway. The townhouse followed a typical plan, with the dining room and kitchen stacked behind the living room. There was a closet beneath the staircase and a powder room as well. Bosch glanced quickly into these rooms, assuming that Chu had already searched them, when he went to get water, and opened the door at the end of the hall. There was no car in the garage. The space was crowded with stacks of boxes and old mattresses leaning against one wall. He turned and headed back to the living room. You don't have a car, Mr. Hardy? He said as he approached the staircase.
I get the taxi when I need to. Don't go up there.
Bosch stopped four steps up and looked at him. Why?
You got no warrant and you got no right.
Is your son upstairs?
No, nobody's up there. But you're not allowed.
Mr. Hardy, I need to make sure we're all going to be safe in here, and that you're going to be safe after we leave. Bosch continued up. Hardy's demand that he not go up gave him caution. As soon as he reached the second level, he drew his gun. Again, the townhouse followed a familiar design. Two bedrooms and a full bath between them. The front bedroom was where Hardy apparently slept. There was an unmade bed and laundry on the floor. A side table had a dirty ashtray, and a bureau had extra oxygen canisters. The walls were yellowed with nicotine, and there was a patina of dust and cigarette ash on everything. Bosch picked up one of the canisters. There was a label that said it contained liquid oxygen and was to be used by prescription only. There was a phone number for pickup and delivery from a company called Ready Air. Bosch hefted the canister. It felt empty, but he wasn't sure. He put it back down and turned to the closet door. It was a walk-in closet with both sides lined with musty clothes on hangers. The shelves above were stacked with boxes that said U-Haul on the sides. The floor was littered with shoes and what looked like previously worn clothes in a laundry pile. He backed out and left the bedroom, proceeding down the hall. The second bedroom was the cleanest room in the home because it appeared to be unused. There was a bureau and a side table, but no mattress
on the bed frame. Bosch recalled the mattress and box spring he had seen earlier in the garage and realized that the set had probably been moved down from here. He checked the closet and found it crowded but more orderly. The clothes were hung neatly in plastic bags for long-term storage. He went back into the hall to check the bathroom.
"Harry, everything okay up there?"
Chu called from downstairs.
"Everything's cool. Be right down."
He reholstered his weapon and leaned his head into the bathroom. Dingy towels hung on a rack, and one more ashtray was on top of the toilet tank. A plastic air freshener sat next to it. Bosch almost laughed at the sight of it. The bathtub enclosure had a plastic curtain with mold on it, and the tub completed the motif with a ring of grime that looked years in the making. Disgusted, Bosch turned to go back down the stairs, but then he thought better of it and turned back into the bathroom. He opened the medicine cabinet and found the three glass shelves fully racked with prescription bottles and inhalers. He randomly took one off its shelf and read the label. It was a 4-year-old prescription to Hardy for something called generic theophylline. He put it back and then took down one of the inhalers. It was another generic prescription, this time for something called albuterol. It was 3 years old. Bosch took down another inhaler and studied it, then another, and then he checked every inhaler and bottle in the cabinet. There were many different generic drugs, and some of the bottles were full, while most of them were almost empty. But there wasn't a prescription in the cabinet that was more recent than 3 years old. Bosch stepped back and closed the cabinet, coming to his own face in the mirror. He looked at his own dark eyes for a long moment. And suddenly he knew. He left the bathroom and walked quickly back to Hardy's bedroom. He closed the door so he would not be heard from the living room. Pulling his phone as he picked up one of the oxygen canisters, he called the number for Ready Air and asked to speak to the delivery and pickup coordinator. He was connected to someone named Manuel.
"Manuel, my name is Detective Bosch. I work for the Los Angeles Police Department, and I am conducting an investigation. I need to know very quickly when you last delivered prescription oxygen to one of your customers. Can you help me?"
Manuel at first thought the call was a joke, a prank perpetrated by a friend.
"Listen to me," Bosch said sternly. "This is no joke. This is an urgent investigation, and I need this information right now. I need you to help me or put me on with someone who can."
There was a silence, and Bosch heard Chu call his name out again. Bosch put down the canister and covered his phone with his hand. He opened the bedroom door.
"I'll be right down," he called out.
He then closed the door and went back to the phone.
"Manuel, are you there?"
"Yes, I can put the name into the computer and see what we have."
"Okay, do it."
"The name is Chilton Aaron Hardy."
Bosch waited and heard typing.
"He's here," Manuel said. "But he doesn't get his O2 from us anymore."
"What do you mean?"
"It shows our last delivery to him was July of 08. He either died or started getting it from somewhere else. Probably somewhere cheaper. We lose a lot of business that way."
"Are you sure?"
"I'm looking at it right here."
"Thank you, Manuel."
Bosch disconnected the call. He put his phone away and pulled his gun back out. Chapter 35. As Bosch descended the stairs, his adrenaline level rose. He saw that Hardy had not moved from his chair, but he